Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the July 31st, 2020 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a huge sand dune. There's one person on the sand dune. Presumably it's Donald Trump. You can't really tell. He's got on a dark blue suit and a red tie, and there's a Make America Great Again hat off to the side, but his head is stuck down in the sand, so you can't see the face. There's a little wisp of blonde hair. Coming down the hill behind him at high speed is a big coronavirus ball, and it's about to roll right over him. The title this week is The Price of Denial: Why the U.S. is Failing to Limit the Spread of the Coronavirus. And that is our first main story. We'll start right there. Hospitalizations, deaths soaring. What happened? The U.S. coronavirus daily death toll broke 1,100 this week for the first time since May, as case numbers rose in 40 states and numerous states set records for hospitalizations and deaths. States across the South and Southwest were overwhelmed by surging infections, feeding case totals that over the past week have regularly topped 60,000 a day, and sending the tally of confirmed U.S. cases near the 4 million mark, with more than 145,000 deaths. Several states faced shortages of intensive care beds. In Florida, at least 50 hospitals were maxed out, while the health officer in Mississippi, where 31 state legislators are infected, said the system risked being thoroughly overwhelmed. California surpassed New York as the state with the most cases, and Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti said the city was on the brink of another lockdown order. A growing number of school districts were opting to begin the school year with partial or full remote learning. The rampant spread in nearly half the country came as once hard-hit countries in Asia and Europe reported low case numbers and reopened businesses and schools. Things are the worst they've ever been in the U.S., and they are spiraling out of control, said Peter Hotez, dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor University. As dozens of states struggled to control the virus, they faced lab backlogs and supply shortages that are creating waits of a week or more for test results, making the tests largely useless in identifying and containing infections. Meanwhile, the Trump administration sought to block billions of dollars in state grants for testing and contact tracing in the upcoming relief bill. President Trump returned to televised briefings for the first time since April in an attempt to reverse plummeting approval ratings. He was somber, advising Americans to wear masks and acknowledging the situation will likely get worse before it gets better. He said his administration is now, 6 months into the pandemic, in the process of developing a strategy to combat what he acknowledged is a vicious and dangerous illness. But he complained that TV coverage was blowing the problem out of proportion and repeated his claim that the virus will disappear. It will disappear. What the editorial said: the United States is plunging ever deeper into a public health catastrophe, said the Washington Post. In the wake of Trump's epic leadership failure, governors should hit the reset button and try once more to get this right. That means shutting down bars, restaurants, gyms, and other indoor spaces where people congregate, and enforcing social distancing. And for heaven's sake, wear a mask, said the Chicago Tribune. Strong evidence shows that masks block infections and could help bring the epidemic under control and save the economy. It's astounding that so many deluded people still resist this basic precaution. Trump is losing the public with his rosy talk, said the Washington Examiner. Bluster and spin go a long way in real estate and reality TV, but they don't work in a pandemic, which is why his poll numbers have cratered. With the U.S. facing devastation as life in Italy and Spain goes back to normal, Trump faces more than a communications problem. It's a results problem. What the columnist said. What we've seen is perhaps one of the greatest failures of presidential leadership in generations, said Michael Shear in the New York Times. Faced with America's biggest crisis in decades, the White House embraced overly rosy projections in order to proclaim victory over the virus and prematurely reopen the economy. They were cheered on by White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx, a constant source of upbeat news, who assured administration officials in mid-April that the virus spread had peaked. The administration was driven by one unwavering goal: shifting responsibility to the states in an attempt to escape blame for the crisis. We've squandered our chance to beat back the crisis, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. Nations across the globe have proved that the virus can be crushed given a consistent government response and mobilized and willing public. But in a country that once led the world, an ineffective patchwork response has left us with overburdened hospitals, doubts that school can safely reopen, and a citizenry that feels it has already sacrificed too much for no visible gain. Hunker down, America, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. This fight is far from over. In a best-case scenario, we'll have a vaccine by early 2021. Even then, we'll have to contend with the lingering economic, geopolitical, social, educational, and psychological consequences of the virus. We'll also face another problem: figuring out how to prevent another pandemic. The conditions that allowed this virus to jump from a bat to a human in China are almost entirely unchanged. Our controversy of the week is titled Election 2020. Is Trump headed for a landslide defeat? If a blue wave won the House for Democrats in the 2018 midterm, said Ed Kilgore in nymag.com, then the general election in November is shaping up to be a Democratic tsunami. With only 100 days to go, this week's ABC News Washington Post poll showed Joe Biden with a stunning 15-point lead over President Trump among registered voters. This came after last week's 15-point Quinnipiac lead and an NBC News Wall Street Journal poll that put Biden up by 11. The picture in battleground states is no less grim for Trump. Biden holds solid single-digit leads in all seven of the states likely to choose the next president, including crucial Florida. He's even running neck and neck with Trump in Texas and is leading in Georgia, a state no Democrat has carried since 1992. Numbers like these don't just make Trump a major underdog, said Chris Saliza in CNN.com. They suggest he could lose big enough to drag down all Republicans on the ballot in November, giving Democrats the Senate and an expanded House majority, and creating a hole that it could take years for the GOP to dig out of. Trump still has his base of white evangelicals and men without college degrees, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. But the rest of his 2016 coalition has seen enough. The white women who chose Trump over Hillary Clinton by 47 to 45 now prefer Biden 55 to 38. Seniors, whom Trump won by 9 points in 2016, now favor Biden by a startling 14 points in the Quinnipiac poll, perhaps because of his disastrous pandemic non-response. Though Trump won the suburbs by 4% in 2016, he's currently losing them by 25%. Big polling leads tend to erode, said Nate Kahn in the New York Times. In late July 1988, Democrat Michael Dukakis led George H.W. Bush by 17 points, while Hillary Clinton led Trump by 7 points in August 2016. But this cycle could be different and more stable. On the dominant issue in American life, the coronavirus pandemic, the simple fact is that voters have an overwhelmingly negative view of how the president has handled it, and the pandemic isn't going away by November. Trump can fix that, said Steve Hilton in FoxNews.com. This week's resumption of daily coronavirus briefings is a good first step, though they might be more effective with Vice President Mike Pence as the face of the federal response. That would free up Trump to focus on growth and jobs using the policies that delivered the greatest economy in U.S. history to deliver it again. Yes, the polls show Trump losing to Biden, said Lynyrd King and Michael Collins in USA Today. They said the same thing 4 years ago against Hillary Clinton. As pollsters always remind us, their surveys are snapshots, not predictors. Trump himself seems to believe he's losing, said Maeve Reston in CNN.com. In a recent Fox News town hall meeting, Trump grumbled to Biden, "He's going to be your next president because people don't love me, maybe." Bewildered and defensive, Trump hasn't offered any semblance of a second-term agenda or any imminent course correction. The snapshot analogy for polls is usually used to suggest a candidate can improve his standing, said Jonah Goldberg in thedispatch.com. But polls can also get worse. With Trump doing nothing to win back disaffected voters, the current polls may be like snapshots of the Titanic leaving port on its fateful journey to the bottom of the sea. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It's a good week for law and order with the arrest of a Michigan woman who offered $5,000 plus travel expenses on rentahitman.com for the murder of her ex-husband. The owner of the fake website says it has helped prevent 130 murders since its founding in 2005. It was a good week for bisexual men who actually do exist, according to a new British study. Once skeptical researcher Garulf Rieger said the penile response data of 400 men exposed to gay and straight pornography was clear proof of bisexual arousal. It was a good week for selective empathy. After President Trump sent well wishes to the accused sex trafficker Ghislaine Maxwell, awaiting trial in jail on charges she procured underage girls for the late Jeffrey Epstein. "I've met her numerous times over the years," noted Trump, who used to socialize with Epstein. "I wish her well." But it was a bad week for mistaken identity. after Republican Senators Marco Rubio and Dan Sullivan both marked the death of civil rights icon Representative John Lewis by posting photographs of themselves with a different black congressman, Representative Elijah Cummings, who died in October. It was a bad week for Governor Kevin Stitt of Oklahoma, who became the first state governor to test positive for coronavirus. Stitt, who said he was shocked by his diagnosis, often goes maskless, and has tweeted a photo of his family dining maskless in a crowded restaurant. And finally, it was a bad week for Q, after Twitter disabled 7,000 accounts dedicated to spreading the QAnon conspiracy theory, which nonsensically holds that JFK Jr. faked his own death and is working with President Trump to round up a ring of child sex traffickers, including Hillary Clinton. And a short news piece before we move on. Confederate flag barred from U.S. bases. Defense Secretary Mark Esper issued new guidelines that effectively bans the Confederate battle flag from Defense Department property. While making no mention of the flag itself, whose display President Trump has supported as a symbol of Southern pride, the new policy limits flags to a short list that includes the U.S. flag, those of the military services, and some others such as the POW/MIA flag. The Marine Corps banned the Confederate flag in April. The military has become deeply embroiled in the debate over symbols of the Confederacy. This week, President Trump threatened to veto a $740 billion military spending bill passed by the House over a provision that would rename bases that honor Confederate officials, such as North Carolina's Fort Bragg. Our briefing page article takes us in a slightly different direction. Nice to get a change of pace sometimes. It's titled, Genetically Modified Mosquitoes. Scientists plan to release altered mosquitoes designed to sabotage the species' ability to reproduce. Is this safe? Who's doing this? The Federal Environmental Protection Agency has approved a plan by a British biotech company called Oxitec to release about 1 billion genetically modified, GM, mosquitoes in the Florida Keys and next year Texas. The mosquitoes, codenamed OX5034, will only be male, the gender that does not bite humans, and will carry a new gene that will be passed on to their female offspring and cause them to die while they're still larvae. Repeated releases of such Trojan horse mosquitoes should kill, in theory, 90% of the local population of the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which is capable of transmitting the Zika and West Nile viruses, as well as dengue and yellow fever. Oxitec claims it's safe and notes that the species is invasive to South Florida anyway. But the plan has drawn protests from residents and some in the scientific community. People here in Florida do not consent to the genetically engineered mosquitoes or to being human experiments, said Barry Ray of the Florida Keys Environmental Coalition. Henry Greeley, a Stanford law professor and bioethicist, said the Oxitec plan reflects the almost limitless possibilities and dangers of genetic technology. We can remake the biosphere to be what we want, from woolly mammoths to non-biting mosquitoes, he said. How should we feel about that? Do we want to live in nature or in Disneyland? How does this technology work? Scientists first genetically modified an animal, a mouse, in 1974. But the process remained cumbersome and slow until the development of the CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R, technique and other gene editing technology this decade. Now scientists can target exactly which genes they want to modify using RNA, break the DNA apart at the gene's location using an enzyme, and then insert a new gene. Last year, University of Georgia researchers created the first genetically modified reptile, a brown anole, and an Indiana company, Aqua Bounty, expects to begin harvesting tons of salmon genetically modified to grow faster at an indoor facility later this year. Critics say this is all moving too fast without adequate study of risks and unintended consequences. J.D. Hansen, policy director for the International Center for Technology Assessment and Center for Food Safety, calls Oxitec's project a Jurassic Park experiment, except without the island. Where do the plans stand? In May, the EPA greenlighted Oxitec's plans for both Florida and Texas, issuing the company an experimental use permit. Florida state authorities followed suit with their own approval. Texas authorities and the Florida Keys Mosquito Control Commission still need to sign off and may face lawsuits. More than 31,000 people filed objections with the EPA, and only 56 expressed support, with some accusing the agency of relying solely on data supplied by Oxitec to issue permits. What could possibly go wrong? Asked Hansen. We don't know, because they unlawfully refuse to seriously analyze environmental risks. What could go wrong? Some geneticists, including Dr. Ricarda Steinbrecher of EcoNexus, a public interest research organization, have raised alarms that Oxitec's altered mosquitoes haven't been adequately studied. The researcher said the underlying mechanism leading to cell death in the larvae aren't fully understood and thus can't yield precise and predictable results. An independent group of researchers also claimed that some of the larvae produced from an earlier Oxitec field study in Brazil survived to sexual maturity and were able to reproduce, introducing the mosquito's modified DNA into the local population. So far, there is no evidence that the resulting hybrid is more robust or dangerous to humans. Critics also warn that the potential removal of even an invasive species from the food chain and ecosystem could have profound unintentional consequences. Many kinds of birds and bats, for example, eat mosquitoes. I'm not sure I care if mosquitoes suffer, if they can suffer, Greeley said. But mammals or birds? I do care. What's the upside? Some see world-changing possibilities. Florida witnessed its first mosquito-to-human transmission of the Zika virus, which causes serious birth defects, in 2016. And West Nile is a perennial problem. As these diseases spread northward in a warming world, the elimination of a species that transmits them could prevent many illnesses and save lives. Meanwhile, a team of scientists led by the renowned botanist Joanne Chory is using CRISPR to create plants capable of storing extra carbon dioxide. Theoretically, if applied on a large scale, such plants could suck more greenhouse gases from the atmosphere and arrest the forces of climate change. I feel like I have the weight of the world on my shoulders, Chory has said. In Australia, researchers are devising a genetically modified coral capable of withstanding rising sea temperatures. The worst thing we could do is ignore genetic engineering because it's frightening for some people, said coral geneticist Lion Bay, and then get 10 or 15 years down the road and realize it's the only option. Time to read a few of this week's columns. We'll start with the unbearable lightness of white fragility. The most popular current book on racism, White Fragility, is actually a racist tract, said John McWhorter. The book by white diversity consultant Robin DiAngelo has become required reading for corporate human resource officers and well-meaning white people embarking on a project of self-criticism. As a black college professor who has not been held back by racism, I found the book deeply condescending. DiAngelo diminishes black people in the name of dignifying us, portraying us as victims with exquisitely sensitive feelings. She correctly observes that all people have some degree of racial bias, but insists that whites are so steeped in white supremacy, they can't perceive just how racist they are. When white people are confronted with their racism, DiAngelo says, they often complain or even burst into self-indulgent tears. White people, she says, should not bother to ask black people about their experiences and feelings because it isn't their responsibility to educate you. Instead, white people should relentlessly do the hard personal work of examining how deeply racist they are. This earnest self-flagellation may make educated white readers feel better about themselves, but it's a poor substitute for vigorous, constructive activism in the real world. Filling a high court vacancy. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's announcement that she is being treated for a recurrence of cancer raises a major question, said Ed Kilgore. What will happen if the 87-year-old justice is forced to leave the Supreme Court before January? President Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell would surely insist on filling any vacancy. McConnell has already stated that he will ignore the precedent he set when he refused to allow hearings on President Obama's nominee to fill Antonin Scalia's seat, Merrick Garland, for 10 months in 2016. Trump, meanwhile, would love a confirmation fight before Election Day to rouse the Republican base. The GOP's elimination of the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees means Democrats couldn't stop confirmation of a new Federalist Society-approved justice. But it would be a holy war for both sides. And what if the vacancy occurred after Joe Biden was elected president, but in the lame duck session between November and January? Conservatives would howl at Trump and McConnell to ram through a confirmation. But if Democrats hold a Senate majority in January, they will react by expanding and packing the court with liberal justices. For the sake of our already divided country, Justice Ginsburg needs to hold on. This is from the United Kingdom. A growing backlash against masks. The new government order that makes it compulsory to wear face masks in shops in England is going to be devastating for human relations, said Camilla Long in the Sunday Times. Maybe months ago, mask wearing might have stopped the spread of COVID-19. But with the disease now largely under control in Britain, after some 300,000 infections and more than 45,000 deaths, putting on a flimsy bit of cloth is a pointless, semi-religious activity for the vacant and pusillanimous middle classes. We can't breathe freely, but we can touch anything we want in the supermarket with our grubby hands. The rule already in place in Scotland makes no sense. Another exercise in dreary conformity, like clapping every night for healthcare workers. I was getting a pedicure the other day, and when word came that city inspectors were on the way, the shopkeeper sent workers racing around frantically, scrambling for their masks. Have we got to the stage of such fear and panic that pedicurists are practically throwing themselves under the counters in terror? The science behind the benefits of mask wearing is pretty solid, said Richard Coker in The Guardian. Even a cloth covering will substantially reduce the number of droplets and aerosols that you can cough, sneeze, or breathe out, making it less likely you'll pass on a nasty virus that you may not know you have. Yet hundreds of anti-mask protesters gathered in London this week to oppose the new rule, spurred on by lawmakers such as Desmond Swain, a member of the ruling Conservative Party, who calls masks a monstrous imposition. We have a history of this sort of intransigence. When smallpox vaccination was made compulsory in the 19th century, dissenters such as George Bernard Shaw howled about infractions of liberty. Eventually, the anti-science crowd won. The mandate was repealed a few decades later, and to this day, the UK doesn't require childhood vaccinations. Still, I expect mask wearing will soon become more prevalent in England, more acceptable, less embarrassing. People have been slow to get the message because our leaders don't model the behavior, said Usma Mir in the Herald. Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak, for example, was all winning smiles and shiny hair, but notably, no mask when he recently launched a new meal voucher program in a restaurant. And Health Secretary Matt Hancock has only confused things with his insistence that masks are compulsory in shops, but not in other enclosed spaces such as pubs and offices. The government isn't listening to its own experts, said Sean O'Grady in independent.co.uk. Science advisors say we should reopen slowly and carefully after suffering the worst COVID-19 outbreak in Europe. But Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who gets bored easily, has insisted on opening everything up. The pubs, the offices, the soccer stadiums. Johnson wants to get back to something like normality by Christmas, virtually ending all restrictions just as the cold weather sets in. If the virus roars back in a second wave, it won't be the mask skeptic's fault. It will be his. Our in-depth article this week also refers back to that cover drawing of President Trump with his head in the sand. It's titled, A Crisis Foretold and Ignored. The United States spent years preparing for a pandemic, said Joel Achenbach in the Washington Post. When one came, the Trump administration ignored the advice of health officials and failed catastrophically in its response. Isabel Papadimitriou, 64, a respiratory therapist in Dallas, has been treating a surge of patients as the Texas economy reopened. She developed coronavirus symptoms June 27th and tested positive 2 days later. The disease was swift and brutal. She died the morning of the 4th of July. The holiday had always been her daughter's favorite. Fiona Tulip loved the family cookouts, the fireworks, the feeling of America united. Now she wonders whether she'll ever be able to celebrate it again. In mourning, she's furious. Tulip, 40, had seen her country fail to control the virus. She had seen Texas ease restrictions even as the case counts and hospitalizations soared. She had seen fellow citizens refuse to wear a mask or engage in social distancing. I feel like her death was 100% preventable. I'm angry at the Trump administration. I'm angry with the state of our politics. I'm angry at the people who even now refuse to wear masks, she said. 6 months after the coronavirus appeared in America, the nation has failed spectacularly to contain it. Many countries have rigorously driven infection rates to nearly zero. In the United States, coronavirus transmission is out of control. The national response is fragmented, shot through with political rancor and cultural war divisiveness. Testing shortcomings that revealed themselves in March have become acute in July, with week-long waits for results, leaving the country blind to real-time virus spread and rendering contact tracing nearly irrelevant. How the world's richest country got into this dismal situation is a complicated tale that exposes the flaws and fissures in a nation long proud of its ability to meet cataclysmic challenges. If there was a mistake to be made in this pandemic, the U.S. has made it. The single biggest miscalculation was rushing to reopen the economy while the virus was still spreading at high rates through much of the country, experts say. The only way to reopen safely, epidemiologists said as far back as early April, was to crush the curve to drive down the rate of viral transmission to the point where new infections were few and far between. Many countries did that. They have managed to avoid the kind of dramatic viral resurgence that is happening in the U.S., Spain, Italy, Germany, and France, all devastated by the virus months ago, drove coronavirus cases and deaths to relatively low levels. And in Asia, the picture is radically different. In Taiwan, baseball fans sit in the stands and watch their teams play. Japan has had fewer than 1,000 deaths from COVID-19. South Korea has had fewer than 300. Vietnam has recorded no deaths from the virus. The United States' mishandling of the pandemic has defied most experts' predictions. In October, not long before the novel coronavirus began sickening people in China, a comprehensive review ranked the pandemic preparedness of 195 countries. The project, called the Global Health Security Index and led by the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and the Nuclear Threat Initiative, assigned scores to countries as a way to warn them of the rising threat of infectious disease outbreaks. With a score of 83.5 out of 100, the U.S. ranked number one. But the death rate from COVID-19 in the U.S. looks like that of countries with vastly lower wealth, healthcare resources, and technological infrastructure. How did the nation get caught so flat-footed? By not really trying, said Beth Cameron, who helped lead the project for the Nuclear Threat Initiative. The federal government punted the coronavirus response to the states, counties, and cities, said Cameron, who was senior director for global health security and biodefense on the White House National Security Council under President Barack Obama. I just never expected that we would have such a lack of federal leadership. And it's been deliberate, she said. In a national emergency that is a pandemic, spreading between states, federal leadership is essential. And if there was any doubt about that, we ran that experiment from March and April until now. It failed. Somehow, this highly mobile virus keeps sneaking up on communities, seeding itself extensively before people detect the breadth and intensity of the attack. That happened catastrophically in New York City early in the pandemic. The new outbreaks have been largely in the South and West. This month, Roy Ramos, a reporter for WPLG-TV in Miami, noticed he had a cough. He and his wife, the station's evening news anchor, Nicole Perez, went to get tested for the coronavirus. Positive, both of them. Soon, another anchor and the station's chief meteorologist had tested positive, too. As of July 14, 10 station employees had tested positive, including some who had not been in the office or in contact with their coworkers. The virus was everywhere in South Florida, which is now reeling from the pathogen's assault. This is not a political message, but a personal one, Perez's co-anchor, Calvin Hughes, told viewers. Please, please wear a mask. In the minds of many Americans, the coronavirus crisis that was so alarming in March and April lost its fearsomeness in May and June when people tried to resume something approximating a normal life. The shutdowns had been miserable, but they'd been effective. The success of the shutdowns meant that many Americans did not personally know anyone sickened by the virus. In places with low transmission rates, the crisis seemed far away. "We just let our guard down," Ohio Governor Mike DeWine, a Republican, said in an interview Friday. Some people, when they heard, "Hey, Ohio's open," what they mentally processed is, "It's safe. We can go out and do whatever we want. It's back to normal." "Florida a month ago is where Ohio is today," the governor said. "If we don't want to be Florida, we got to change what we're doing. Everybody's got to mask up." Kristen Urquiza, 39, said she tried warning her father, Mark, a lifelong Republican, against going out and risking infection. In their home state of Arizona, as leaders including Republican Governor Doug Ducey sprinted to reopen in May and June, Urquiza could tell she was losing the argument. "When the president, the governor, and people on cable news are all saying one thing, how do you compete with that?" she said. He would push back. "I hear what you're saying, but why would the governor say it's safe to go out if it's not true?" Her father died of the virus June 30th. In the obituary she wrote, she lashed out at government leaders. "He was a huge supporter of Trump and Arizona Governor Ducey. He believed what they said, and they betrayed him," she said in an interview. Even before the pandemic hit, local public health agencies had been devastated by years of staffing and budget cuts. They had lost almost a quarter of their overall workforce since 2008, a cut of almost 60,000 workers, according to National Associations of Health Officials. The agency's main source of federal funding, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Emergency Preparedness Budget, had been cut 30% since 2003. The public health challenges are keenly felt in Malheur County, a vast swath of mostly federal rangeland in rural eastern Oregon. About a quarter of its 30,000 residents live in poverty. Teen pregnancy rates are double the statewide rate. There's one school nurse for 10,000 square miles. Drug use is high. The first coronavirus case hit March 30th, and for more than a month, the county averaged 1 to 2 cases a week. There was resistance to a statewide shutdown in the conservative area, but most people were willing to observe temporary restrictions, said Sarah Poe, director of the county health department. But after a month or so, residents began to complain of government overreach. Many felt they had to resume working to survive, she said. People's response has been just take care of themselves. Take care of your own business, your own family, Poe said. That's not how this virus works. Now the coronavirus is a full-blown crisis in Malheur County. Cases began soaring 3 weeks ago to 15 or 16 a day. As of the Friday, the county had 477 cases. The cumulative positive rate since the first case is nearly 16%, quadruple the state's rate. Last week, facing an accelerating caseload, Malheur County commissioners passed a resolution that goes further than the state's mask order. It recommends gatherings of no more than 10 people indoors or 25 outdoors, and mask wearing in groups indoors and out. But resistance in the county remains high. Poe said she regularly gets hate mail and phone calls accusing her of peddling a hoax. "We're up against just a ton of misinformation," she said. "What are we fighting here? We're fighting a virus, and our goal is to save lives. Let's not be distracted into fighting other people." The United States, experts say, is approaching a tipping point at which its public health systems could become so overwhelmed that they begin to collapse. Already, coronavirus test results take so long to come back that they are almost useless for anything except as a historical record. The delays have a cascading effect. Contact tracing is rendered ineffectual. Containing the virus by isolation becomes impossible. And as hospitals fill, the virus fatality rate could inch upward because of overtaxed ICU nurses and doctors struggling to care for so many. But the most dangerous cascading effect could be despair. A loss of hope, along with the resolve to fight the virus, warned Michael Osterholm, director of the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. When that happens, you lose the ability to act rationally. You lose the commitment to fight. You lose all chance of beating back the virus. Adam Fleming Petty, a writer in Grand Rapids, Michigan, said he feels that demoralization acutely, as well as so much rage at Trump and other political leaders whose measures did not quell the virus enough to allow many schools to open. One thing I told myself was, okay, as long as school starts back up in the fall, I can do this. I can make it through the summer if I have that goal waiting for me. Now that goal isn't there anymore, said Petty. This crisis has been sucked inexorably into the vortex of political polarization. Trump repeatedly downplayed the viral threat. You have 15 people, and the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero, he said in late February. On Twitter, he cheered on citizen protests of shutdowns that had been ordered by Democratic governors. He did not wear a mask in public until July 11th. Many Americans now believe the pandemic has been exaggerated or even fabricated by scientists and the mainstream news media. The rejection of scientific expertise has flowered into a conspiracy theory holding that the experts are lying as part of a political agenda. The most outrageous lies are the ones about COVID-19. Everyone is lying. The CDC, media, Democrats, our doctors, not all but most that we are told to trust. Former Wheel of Fortune game show host Chuck Woolery tweeted July 12th. Trump retweeted that. Days later, Woolery revealed that his son was sick with the virus, and he has since taken down his Twitter account. As she prepared for a three-day drive across the country from New York to Texas to bury her mother, Tulip said she has been thinking a lot about what it means to be American. She was raised like many Texans, unabashedly proud of her roots and her patriotism. I grew up a Dallas Cowboys fan, all about the stars and stripes. You know that song, Proud to Be an American? We would literally sing that as kids in elementary school and mean every word. Now she said she feels betrayed by both her country and home state. For the past 2 weeks, she and her husband have been calling funeral homes in Brownsville, unable to get through because the town has been overwhelmed by the virus. I desperately want to believe we as a country can change, that we can recover from where we are now, she said. I want to believe that America can get back to who we were, a proud country, one where people can thrive and not suffer. A version of this article originally appeared in the Washington Post. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The civil rights icon who became the conscience of Congress, John Lewis, 1940 to 2020. John Lewis spent his life fighting for racial justice as one of the giants of the civil rights movement, and then as a 17-term U.S. representative known as the conscience of Congress. A protege of Martin Luther King Jr., Lewis spent the 1960s on the front lines of the battle to end segregation, combining a commitment to nonviolence with a bulldog tenacity that carried him through dozens of arrests and jailings and many brutal beatings from police and white mobs. Lewis led lunch counter sit-ins, was among the 13 original freedom riders who challenged the segregation of interstate buses, and helped organize the 1963 March on Washington. On March 7, 1965, Lewis led one of the era's most pivotal actions, a march for voting rights in Selma, Alabama. Billy Club-wielding state troopers met the peaceful marchers with sheer brutality, wounding dozens and cracking the 25-year-old Lewis's skull. Televised footage of the assaults spurred outrage and rallied support for the landmark Voting Rights Act, which was signed into law 5 months later. "The marchers literally, in my estimation, wrote the Voting Rights Act," said Lewis, "with our blood and with our feet on the streets of Selma." The son of sharecroppers and the third of 10 children, Lewis grew up picking cotton and peanuts near Troy, Alabama, said the New York Times. The house had no plumbing or electricity. In the outhouse, they used the pages of an old Sears catalog as toilet paper. His family nicknamed him Preacher, and becoming one seemed to be his destiny. Responsible for the farm's chickens, he fancied them as his congregation, giving them Bible readings, baptisms, and funerals. Bristling at the South's entrenched segregation and the local library's refusal to grant him a card, he drew inspiration from the radio addresses of the young Martin Luther King, imagining, he later said, that King was speaking directly to me, saying, "You can make a difference." Lewis moved to Nashville in 1958 to attend the American Baptist Theological Seminary, where aspiring black preachers willing to take campus jobs could attend free, said the Washington Post. He found the pull of social activism irresistible and was soon engaging in sit-ins and voter registration drives and enduring beatings and his first arrest. The latter, he later wrote, felt like a step through the door into total, unquestioning commitment. In 1960, Lewis helped found the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which organized demonstrations across the South. He moved to Atlanta in 1963 to become the group's chairman, earning $10 a week plus rent for a dingy apartment. As the civil rights movement gave way to the more militant black power movement, Lewis saw his pacifist ideas fall out of favor, said the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Ousted from the SNCC in 1966, along with the notion of nonviolence, he was replaced by the firebrand Stokely Carmichael. Lewis headed the Voter Education Project for much of the 1970s, and in 1977 was named director of a federal volunteerism agency by then-President Jimmy Carter. Lewis' political career began in 1981, when he was elected to the Atlanta City Council, said the Los Angeles Times. 5 years later, he was elected to Congress, representing a district that includes much of Atlanta. Age did not blunt his dedication to nonviolent direct action, said the Times from UK. As a congressman, Lewis was arrested at the protest against apartheid in South Africa and genocide in Darfur. He worked to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1991, which prohibits employment discrimination, and to create the National Museum of African American History. He fought for gun control and the rights of gays and lesbians. In 2011, Lewis was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by Barack Obama. Despite being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer last December, in June he joined a protest near the White House following the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police, and was deeply moved by the resulting uprising. "People now understand what the struggle was all about," he said. "It's another step down a very, very long road toward freedom, justice for all humankind. And we've just enough time for a couple of short notes. More than 6 million people enrolled in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, commonly referred to as food stamps, in the first 3 months of the pandemic, from February to May. It was the fastest ever expansion of the program. A 3-mile stretch of new border wall in Texas built by a private group is in danger of collapsing into the Rio Grande because of erosion. President Trump now says this portion of the wall was only done to make me look bad, but he lobbied for the builder, Fisher Sand and Gravel, to get a $1.7 billion federal wall building contract. And we'll finish up with a quote. Today we'll take this one from economist John Kenneth Galbraith, who says, "Meetings are indispensable when you don't want to do anything." And another short one, Don DeLillo says, "Longing on a large scale is what makes history." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138.